Carmen LaSalle here, and I'm welcoming you to part two of the kickoff of Media Alliance's 30th birthday celebration. This was a conversation between Alice Walker, a foremost American writer and activist, and Amy Goodman, the host of the television show Democracy Now! This talk took place at the First Congregational Church in Oakland, California, on January 27, 2006, and this is part two. In this part, you will hear Amy ask Alice about The Color Purple in its various forms, Broadway play, movie, and book. They will discuss the Harlem Writers Guild and Alice's journey to Florida to uncover Zora Neale Hurston's grave.
I went to see the Broadway play, The Color Purple, two nights ago with my friend and colleague, Democracy Now! Producer Yoruba Richin, who's here tonight. Yoruba, where are you? There she is. And we were both overwhelmed by the play. But I wanted to ask you about first the book, then the movie, then the play. And you write about the making of the movie in The Same River Twice, honoring the difficult. What about this creation that you have given birth to, then taking these other forms? What was it like first to make the movie? Because you were a critical part of that, though you didn't determine the whole thing.
It was a great risk. It was a great risk. But I grew up in Eatonton, Georgia, actually not even in the town, way out in the beautiful, luckily beautiful countryside. But our entertainment was on Saturday night to, you know, bathe and get dressed and go to see a film. Now, these were all, in retrospect, really pretty awful films. They were all shooting and killing each other, you know. But that was all that we had, really, in the way of entertainment that wasn't the church and our own entertainments. So that's what I grew up with. And my mother, who worked so hard and never left the house or left the fields, you know, she would sometimes be able to go. After eight children, it was sometimes difficult to even move, but she enjoyed these things, these movies. And so the risk that I took was in a way to offer to my mother and people like my mother something that they could identify with, something that they could, you know, have some real connection to. I mean, my mother never met Tom Mix and Lash LaRue. These were all these, you know, characters that were, you know, always shooting and killing. So I thought about, you know, the segregated theater. You know, when I was growing up, we had to be up there in the balcony, and the white people were down here, and of course the seats were better down here. So I wanted to change that to the degree that I could do so. And so that's why, that's part of the reason I wanted to make a film. And I think, you know, I had never heard of Steven Spielberg when he appeared. I think that for many people that's amazing, given how famous he was, but I had no idea who he was. And that's the other thing, you know, when you are working on your work, and I think it's really important that I talk to you about this a little bit as an elder. When you are working on your work, you really don't have to be concerned about what other people are doing. And when, you know, there's an expression, everything that rises must converge. At some point, if your work is as true as you can make it, it has its own luminosity. And it inevitably brings to you and your work all the people that you need. So enter Steven Spielberg to make the film, which turned out to be a very good thing. People thought it was a terrible choice. But what I looked for in him and in other people is the willingness to listen and the willingness to grow, to learn, and he had all of that.
The questions that were raised here, you had written it deeply out of your own experience. Then having a white producer produce it and going on to Broadway, well, that's just repeated over and over. What were your thoughts of having your experience, your writing, your art channeled through them?
Well, I have fallen in love with the imagination. And if you fall in love with the imagination, you understand that it's a free spirit. It will go anywhere and it can do anything. So your job is to find trustworthy companions and co-creators. That's really it. And if you find them, and I don't know how you... I can only go by how I feel about people. And so with the play, this young man, Scott Sanders, who was the primary producer, went to great lengths to woo me because I was not interested in doing a musical, partly because of the suffering that had occurred after making the film. There was so much incredible controversy after the film, and a lot of it excruciatingly hurtful. And even though I had ways to buffer myself, and even though by nature I can continue to function and do things that I need to do, it was still very painful, so I didn't really want to go back to that.
What was most painful?
What was most painful was being misunderstood. And I understood later that that's an Aquarian thing, that we can take almost anything, but don't misunderstand us. Because we feel deeply wounded by that. And I felt that anybody reading The Color Purple, or seeing the film, actually, that they could read it and see the film and still think that I hated, actually anybody, but, you know, hated my father, my grandfather, my brothers, my, you know, uncles, just because they were black men. And, you know, this would mean that I hated Langston Hughes, you know, or Jean Toomer, or Richard Wright, or, you know, Ralph Ellison, or... It felt so incredibly mean. It felt very mean, it felt very small, and it was very painful.
And so how did you get through it? How did you weather this storm?
Well, I came down with Lyme disease in the middle of all of this, and I experienced it actually as a spiritual transformation, even though I didn't know that was going to be the result. It was very frightening. But I came out the other end of, you know, the bashing that I had received, the physical debilitation from Lyme disease, the breakup of my relationship with a partner at the time. I came out of all of that with a renewed sense that life itself, no matter what people are slinging at you, no matter what is happening, life itself, basic life, is incredibly precious and wonderful, and that we are so lucky to have that. You know, that we wake up in the morning, that we hear a bird, you know, that we... I mean, you know, just if you think about little things, they seem little, but they're so magical. You know, like eating a peach. I came through that period understanding that I am an expression of the divine, just like a peach is, just like a fish is. I have a right to be this way. And being this way, The Color Purple is the kind of work that comes to me. I can't apologize for that. nor can I change it, nor do I want to. So there was this marvelous feeling, you know, that I had already been through a kind of crucifixion by critics. I understood so many things. For instance, you know, in the Gnostic Gospels, they say that when Jesus was crucified, he was not really crucified, that he in the body, that what happened was he understood that it was all rather laughable. And not to compare myself with Jesus, but I really got it. I got it that there is a point at which, you know, a certain kind of crucifixion leads to a certain kind of freedom, because you cannot be contained by other people's opinions of you. You will always, I think, after you go through this kind of thing, feel somewhat removed, as I do. You know, I basically stopped reading reviews. And it's fine. I realize I don't need them. I really feel that if more people could pay less attention to other people's opinions of them, they would be so much happier.
Alice, I wanted to ask you about the sisterhood. Who was this group of women writers in the 1970s that you gathered with?
Well, the sisterhood was the brainchild of myself and June Jordan, because we looked around one day. We were friends, and we felt that it was very important that Black women writers know each other, that we understood that we were never in competition for anything, that we did not believe in ranking. We would not let the establishment put one of us ahead of the other. And so some of us were Verda Mae Grosvenor, Indazaki Shange, Toni Morrison, June Jordan, myself, and I think Audrey Ballard, who was at Essence, and several other women that I don't tonight remember. The very first meeting was at June's apartment, because it was the larger of mine. I had moved out of my marriage house into basically two small rooms. And so June had this beautiful apartment with lots of space, and the women gathered there. And I remember on the very first gathering, I had bought this huge red pot that became the gumbo pot, and I made my first gumbo and took it to this gathering of women, all so different and all so spicy and flavorful, like gumbo. And we have this photo. There's a wonderful photograph that someone took of us gathered around a large photograph of Bessie Smith, because Bessie Smith best expressed our feeling of being women who were free and women who intended to stay that way.
You talked about criticism earlier and how you decided never to read reviews. Can you talk about it in terms of Toni Morrison's early work and what it meant to champion her then, and what was the response of the critics?
Well, I thought that her writing was beautiful. I had read The Bluest Eye and, in fact, was passing it out to people. And I was very upset that, you know, it didn't get much of a long life. I think I don't know if it went out of print, but it certainly was sort of below the surface. And then I read Sula, which I just fell in love with. And I remember that there was a review of it in the New York Times by Sarah Blackman, I think. Anyway, someone who basically said that in order for Toni Morrison ever to, you know, be anything in the literary world, she had to get out of this notion of writing about Black women. And she had to broaden her horizons. And that way she would, you know, maybe connect. And I was just completely annoyed. And I wrote a letter to the Times reminding her and them that we will never have to be other than who we are in order to be successful. Okay, it says, "Dear Sir, I am amazed on many levels by Sarah Blackburn's review of Sulla. Is Miss Morrison to, quote, transcend herself? And why should she, and for what? The time has gone forever when black people felt limited by themselves. We realize that we are, as ourselves, unlimited, and our experience is valid. It is for the rest of the world to recognize this if they choose."
You also championed Zora Neale Hurston. Can you talk about who Zora Neale Hurston is and why you did and what you did to make her known in life and death?
When I was still a student at Sarah Lawrence, I met Langston Hughes. Now, Langston and Zora had been really good friends for many, many years, but did he tell me that? No, he didn't mention it. Because it wouldn't matter. I didn't know him either. I was completely ignorant. And I start this way because he asked me for a story to put in his anthology, which he was doing at the time. And it was called The Best Short Stories by Negro Writers, and I was the youngest one in it. There was also a story by Zora called The Gilded Six Bits, but because at that time, we thought that the real writers were men. It was 10 years before I even realized that she was in the same anthology that I was in. So that's just to give you a little background about Zora and me. So then later, when I was living in Mississippi and working in the movement, I was writing a story about voodoo, and I needed accurate information from anthropologists. Well, the only anthropologists that I could find were white and racist. And one of them actually said that that there was some question about whether the Negro had a large enough brain. So I threw his book away. But before I did, I noticed that there was a footnote with her name. He had basically ripped off her work, and there she was as a footnote in his work. So I knew what to start looking for, and I found Mules and Men, one of her books. And that was the book that really helped me to complete my story, because this is how it is. This is what it means to have a culture. You can use it. It is there for your use. That's the whole point. I mean, this is not use in the sense of ripoff. This is like use in the sense of nourishment. She wanted me to know what was going on with voodoo. So then someone told me about Their Eyes Were Watching God. I completely fell in love with the novel. I could not believe that we didn't know about it, that it had been out of print. All of her work had been out of print for 30 years. Then there was a biography that Robert Hemingway wrote that really gave us a lot of information about her literary work. And he mentioned that she had been buried somewhere in Florida, but they didn't know where. And having read Their Eyes Were Watching God, I could not imagine that any of us could think that we were really living our best lives with her just thrown away somewhere and we didn't even know where. So I decided to go and try to find where she was. And that adventure, I had a little child, and I really thought about, you know, leaving early in the morning to go to Florida to try to find this place that I didn't know, you know, where it was. I thought about, you know, hoping that later on she would understand that, you know, to be a mother, for us to be mothers in a world like this, it means that you're trying to do so many different things, including keeping a culture alive for your children to inherit. So I went to Florida. I had a companion, this wonderful woman, who drove me around. But when we finally got to this place, I went to the funeral home, and the people said, well, you know, it was so long ago, and we think that she's out there in something called the Garden of the Heavenly Rest. But nobody's been out there for years, and she's the only person out there. And it was just a big field of weeds. So we went, and I went, Charlotte, who was a Floridian, said, well, you know, I'll do the driving, and I'll stay near the car, but I'm not going out there in the weeds because of, you know, snakes and, I don't know, alligators, whatever they have down there in Florida. But I went on, and I really was feeling very frustrated and like, where to start? And I realized that when you don't know where to start, you just call for whatever help you can imagine. And I started calling her, herself. And almost immediately I stepped into this hole that was a sunken grave. And then I put a stone there, and I went to go to the stonemason, you know, where they make the real stones. And I like to tell this part because it's important, I think, for us to understand that sometimes we don't have the resources to do what we wish we could do. There was a beautiful stone called Ebony Mist that was very tall and black and majestic, and Zora would have loved it, but I couldn't afford that. So I got one that's very modest, but the love of it is what is important, and that was placed, you know, around this area. And now what is so remarkable is that every year there is a huge festival in that area, and thousands of people go to visit her grave. And I think to answer you more fully, I think part of it was my understanding of who Zora was. Zora was an aunt. She was the aunt who was not your mother. You know, your mother had basically, I mean, this is not every mother, but often in the South at that time, and for many, and even now actually, your mother is the one who on some level has given up. She stayed put. You know, she is not going to Honduras. You know, she is not going to Paris. She's going to be right there. But the aunt is going to Honduras, she's going to Cuba, she's going to Paris, she's going to Madrid, she's just going to go. That's the aunt. That's what aunts are for. Aunts go. And then aunts go, and then they come back. They come back and they tell you, well, yeah, well, I went to the horizon. And I got there and I noticed that it was still ahead of me. You see? Your mother's not going to tell you that.
What about advice to parents as a daughter and as a mother?
That's a really difficult one, you know, because I thought I had been a fairly good parent, but my daughter says no. So I think what I have learned because my daughter says no is that parents need more support. And so much of our effort in transforming the world so that we can thrive has to be about supporting families and supporting whatever kind of family, you know, and supporting parents. Because when I was having my child with me growing up, I felt so alone. I felt, you know, there was just me and her. And that is not the way it's supposed to be. We are supposed to be bringing up these children that we have in community. There should be many aunts around and many uncles and many people who love them and who can also give the mother a break and the father. Although often the father has taken the break by going to the office. So more support for families.
Speaking of being a mother and beyond just the mother of your own child, you went to Houston, to the Astrodome, to mother many people. Can you talk about the response to Hurricane Katrina, your assessment of it, and what you think needs to be done?
Well, I will tell you why I went. I was, I turned on the television, and for like 2 or 3 minutes, there was empathy. I could feel the people having empathy for the people who were suffering. But then almost immediately, that empathy started to be twisted into judgment and disdain and disgust. And they kept, you remember this, they kept showing the black people looting and the white people finding food. So as a Southerner, I felt this insult very, very keenly because I know black Southern people. Now, I know that there are crack addicts everywhere and people who are out of their minds for various reasons. So that's true. And I think there were a lot of those people in New Orleans, as there are around, our neighborhoods. But having grown up in the South, I knew the people, the other people, the rest of the people were just the way they've always been. And I knew that the real story was that they were trying to help each other. They were trying to get out of there. They were trying to keep their families together. They were looking after the children. They were just being Southern black people. And in some cases, you didn't see many white people, but they were there too. And I know as Southerners, they also would have been doing these things. So I was very disturbed and offended. Because in my culture, Southern black culture, and in my personal family, it is thought that to hurt someone's feelings is about the worst thing you can do. You must never hurt somebody's feelings. Now, in this, culture, that seems so quaint. But in fact, it's very deep, because once you hurt someone's feelings, they have to carry that pain and that grievance about the unfairness of it forever. And so I knew that the people who were being maligned were suffering from this feeling of being hurt in this way. They really had to feel terrible about being seen as rapists, looters, robbers, killers, thieves. I'm not saying there weren't some of all of those things, but, that's not all the people who were there. So I decided that it was important to go and be with them in just a really small way. I mean, I called my nephew and my niece from Atlanta. I went with my friend William, and we just took ourselves. I took books and some money and some clothing, but mostly I wanted to take the books because I knew that if I were stuck somewhere and I didn't know what was going to happen, I would want to read. So we loved books, and when we got to the Astrodome in Houston, we created an altar. And the altar was just piled high with books and, a few dolls and, things that people might want. But it was just being able to walk through that space and to look into the eyes of people and to say, I know your humanity. I know that you're being maligned. I'm not mistaken and I'm not fooled. I know who you are. And I'm here to show you that I know who you are. And I think that is also what we really need to do more of. We need to believe in the people that we know. If we know that people are good and people are decent and people are trying their best to live honorable lives, we know this. When the television, you know, when the horrible news coverage says that there are this bad thing and that bad thing, we really have to just stand firm in what we know about them, and we have to express it. We have to do everything we can to express to whoever is suffering in this way that we see them. We see them in their realness. And so when we were there, sure enough, there they were. You know, they had managed to take that Astrodome, and they had made little family sections, very neat, you know, very, it was, and some of the people were there by now sitting with their, you know, beds, bunk beds, and the clothes they had managed to get, very much like they were on their own front porches in New Orleans, because that's who they are, you know.
There's this quote, I don't know who said it, "I look back on my life, at all the times I thought I went too far, and I realize now that I didn't go far enough." Do you feel you've gone far enough?
Well, I think I've gone pretty far. I have gone to the limit of my strength and beyond. I think that's why I got so sick and why periodically, you know, I used to joke about how I would be so tired coming from some, you know, event or some gathering or some march. I would be so tired that it felt like I go to the country to rejuvenate, because I was born in the country and I love being in nature. But I had the feeling that I was crawling. My house is there, is on a hill, and I had this distinct impression that I had gotten so tired that even though I was in a car, that I was crawling up the hill, and I would sometimes get there and I could not do anything but just lie on the ground. And the ground, which we really must not let them take from us, the ground is the most incredible medicine. How many of you lie on the ground? Great. Because that is one of the most overlooked medicines, to be full-bodied on the ground and just lie there and let it support you and let it take all of the exhaustion, all of the sadness, all of the sorrow. Just let it sink into the earth. The earth can actually hold it and then send back up to you new strength. So I think that, you know, part of the reason I now paint is that this is what I want to do. I just want to paint.
Could you read "Be Nobody's Darling"?
Oh, yes. Be nobody's darling. Be an outcast. Take the contradictions of your life and wrap around you like a shawl to parry stones to keep you warm. Watch the people succumb to madness with ample cheer. Let them look askance at you, and you askance reply. Be an outcast. Be pleased to walk alone, uncool, or line the crowded riverbeds with other impetuous fools. Make a merry gathering on the bank, where thousands perished for the brave hurt words they said. But be nobody's darling. Be an outcast, qualified to live among your dead.
Alice Walker, thank you very much.
I hope you have enjoyed listening to Amy Goodman in conversation with Alice Walker, an evening celebration of Media Alliance's 30-year anniversary. You can find Media Alliance on the web at www.media-alliance.org. This is Carmen LaSalle for San Francisco Liberation Radio, an internet radio station serving the San Francisco Bay community and the world since 1992. You can tune in at www.liberationradio.net. Music is by Chris Potter and Late Baked Productions.